Well, we will get to Thursday night film reviews in a few minutes' time. But first tonight, congratulations to Angela Flannery. Angela's novel, The Amusements, won the 2023 Kerry Group Irish Novel of the Year last night at the opening night of Listowel Writers Week. The Amusements is Angela's first novel. Set in Tramore, County Waterford, local teenagers Helen Grant and Stella Swin dream of getting out of what they see as a dreary seaside town. I'm delighted that Angela Flannery joins us on the line now. Because there was a time, Angela Flannery, when you might have been sitting opposite me here getting ready to do movie reviews, but the writing clearly has taken precedence, and with very good reason. This is a wonderful award to win, Angela, the Kerry Group Irish Novel of the Year. One of the most prestigious prizes, €20,000 is the value. Mm-hmm. How did you hear the news, first of all?
Well, I heard it sitting in the audience with everybody else in a very, very warm room in the Listowel Arms Hotel with, I think, about 200 other people. And yeah, it was the loveliest surprise I think I've ever had. It was quite incredible.
Yeah, so you're sitting there, you hadn't even, there were no hints, there was no kind of, be ready, nothing like that. You were sitting there with the other nominees, and it was, if your name's called, you've won. And if not, have your good face ready.
Exactly that, yeah. And I had been sitting beside one of the judges, Manveen Rana, for dinner beforehand, and she has some poker face, that lady, I'll tell you. and previous winners, there's one previous winner who I won't name, but he had said to me that if you get a really nice room, you're probably in with a shot. So I had a lovely room, but it wasn't as lovely as the one he described. So I thought, oh, well, never mind, I'm here anyway. And just to be shortlisted, Sean, it was just such an honour. Because it was a very strong shortlist, and two of my favourite short story writers, Adrian Duncan and Louise Kennedy, were on it, and then they went and wrote novels, and they were shortlisted for those, and I thought, oh dear, now this is, and also, their books were two of my favourite books last year, personally, that I'd read, so I felt a great sense of achievement just to even be alongside writers who I respect so much.
Louise and Adrian, as you said, and the other two shortlisted writers, Audrey McGee and Anya Bergman, it certainly was a very strong shortlist. Your debut novel. Now, you had written short stories before, but when you've written a debut novel like that, what was your hope for it, Angela?
Well, I mean, the first thing, I had written another novel, that was in the novel fair a couple of years ago, and that, that got me kind of into the MFA in creative writing in UCD. Hmm. So The Amusements was actually my second novel, but I have been writing short stories. And the big thing is you want to find an agent and you want to find a publisher. And so when that happened, you kind of think, okay, Arash, I've done that now, and the book is going to be out in the world and in people's hands, and I'm going to see it in bookshops, which is all very surreal and lovely and amazing. So the most that you hope for at that point is that people will read it and enjoy it. And everything else is, that's the biggest thing. So when something like this happens, it's kind of surreal. But the book has been very well received, and I've been incredibly fortunate, So I mean, I don't want to sound too pleased. I'm very pleased, but you can't sound too pleased with yourself at the same time. It means so much. And mainly because, it's a huge prize. Hmm. €20,000, which obviously if you work in the arts in any capacity, money is always welcome to buy you time to do what it is that you do.
But apart from that,
and the Arts Council has been really supportive to me in that as well with bursaries. But the respect for this award, I think it becomes, it's really because of the previous winners. So when you look at Anne Enright and Roddy Doyle and Claire Keegan, and of course William Trevor, whose short story Honeymoon in Tramore was what inspired me to write The Amusements.
That's nice company to be in. And you mentioned there that the William Trevor short story set in Tramore was part of the inspiration for The Amusements. But your family has connections to the town of Tramore.
I was born in Waterford, so we left Waterford when I was 8. I was born in Waterford City. So my early childhood memories are of going out to Tramore. And my mother moved to Tramore after my father died. She's from South Kilkenny, but that's where people gravitate towards when you're from South Kilkenny, is Waterford. So she's moved back down there. So as an adult, I wouldn't have been there at all. Really, The Amusements is the story of two teenage girls growing up there and the community around them. I would have spent no time there whatsoever as a teenager. I grew up in Dublin. But I have been able to go back down there as an adult, as of my siblings with our children, and they've spent their early childhood, you know, on the beach and stuff down there. And so, but it means that I can be there all year round. So I see Tremor in all of its different, and this goes for any seaside town. I mean, in the Stole earlier today, I was talking about Ballybunion. This way people from Galway will think of Salt Hill, or you might think of Bundoran this way, or Bray, you know, that there's a very different complexion around a seaside town in the winter when the tourists and when the day trippers are gone. And I really wanted to get that, to start with that. And so that is how the Amusements opens, with the words, it was the off season.
Yeah, and the Amusements,
behind the rigging.
The Amusements are referenced. I mean, I know what it is. I'm sure lots of people. It is the bumping cars and the swing boats and all of those things. It's the collective term for all of that. And as well as that winter period being an important aspect of the novel itself, the fact that it is a seaside town that has the up season, if you like, as well. Did that feed into the writing of the novel? Are there kind of different energies that you get in a place like Tremor, seaside town like that?
Yeah, because of the seasonality of it, you know, so you're there watching as the weather changes, the population, you know, the sound, the smell, everything in the place changes as the seasons change. And then, of course, the years pass by and people grow up there and they leave. And people who visited there, their childhood memories are from there. And it was that collectivism and that kind of, you know, it's a polyphonic novel. So you hear not from just from the two main characters, but from, you know, people who live in this town, people who visit the town. And so, yeah, absolutely. The summer, you know, the memory of summer holidays and the role of memory is a huge thing in it. And I think, that was a very big part of it. All right.
Well, I guess having won the prestigious award, you better get off and start, if you haven't already started, on novel number 3. As it is now, but the very best of congratulations, and enjoys the success of it all, and I hope that the award helped you and gives you the time to do what you want to do. Angela, thanks for joining us this evening. That's Angela Flannery there, whose novel The Amusements is published by Sandy Cove, and as we said, has just been announced as the winner of the 2023 Kerry Group Irish Novel of the Year Award. So too are movie reviews. On this Thursday evening, we have a modern-day reimagining of Carmen, starring Paul Mescal as a member of the US Border Patrol who comes across the emigrant, a woman called Carmen. The true story of an American whistleblower who has to face the music when the FBI come knocking in on her door in the film Reality. How many Spider-Men does it take to screw a light bulb? Depends on which part of the Spider-Verse you happen to be in. Not sure if I understand that, but there you go. We review the latest in the Spider-Man animated feature sequence. And in The Boogeymen, keep calling it The Boogeymen, The Boogeyman, the grieving Harper family are haunted by a demonic presence. The intrepid Deirdre Maloney and Dave Hanratty have been to the cinema, and they're both with me in studio this evening. We start with Carmen. I don't know where quite to start with this one, Dave. Am I anywhere near Bizet's opera? Do I need to be an opera buff and know that story inside out to go near this film?
I didn't, so no, you're fine. It's barely a reimagining. It's kind of Benjamin Millepied, who is the French director, first-time director, choreographer and dancer, husband of Natalie Portman, worked on Black Swan. He's got some pedigree in this world. He has said himself that this is set in a parallel universe, essentially. He wanted to kind of do maybe a traditional retelling of it, but once it was all said and done, it barely has any connection to the original beyond the name. And I guess, you know, woman in peril type thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can go in with just completely fresh eyes. And it's not even, it's melodramatic, but it's not terribly operatic.
But there's a lot of dancing and a lot of singing in here as well. Certainly dance maybe more so even than singing, I think, Deirdre.
Yeah, and I think Dave really hit the nail on the head there with describing it as melodramatic, because in terms of genre, it's really more a melodrama rather than a musical per se. But even in melodrama, you know, it's in the title, melodrama. Music is an absolutely, you know, essential part of this movie. And really the director's background in dancing and choreography really shows, because the dance sequences in this film are really, really stunning. Yeah. And they're one of the elements of the movie that I probably liked more. So the lead actress, Melissa Barrera, she has kind of a background in, she'd probably be best known for her roles in the recent Scream Legacy sequel, but she was also in The Heights. So she definitely has a musical background herself. And we also get to see Paul Mescal sing and dance in this movie, which I think all of Paul Mescal's fans. I don't know what they're called now, Mescalites, Mescalons, or whatever it is. I think that that's kind of the big selling point for this movie is probably Paul Mescal.
Yeah, the dancing is impressive, no doubt about that. And the singing. We knew he had a singing voice, of course, because of the thing of him in the Phantom of the Opera as a secondary school pupil. But here he is. He slips up silently by himself, a bit of a loner, up to a little spot on a kind of disused site of some kind, takes out his guitar and starts to noodle. And here's what happens.
River, come and carry me till I return to whiskey, bone and stone. Brave wing spirit, guide us home. Don't slip away. Stray with me forever. Sandals, the ocean, don't slip away. Only wild open plains.
There you go, Paul Mescal. Singing in the film, Carmen. There's nothing he can't do, it would seem, Dave Hanratty.
It is quite ridiculous. Yeah, I was just saying off mic that I'm glad I like him, because if I didn't like him, I would despise this man for being so damn talented.
Now, let's just clarify, though, the Carmen aspect of it. It is shifted totally from a tobacco factory and cigarette smoking and soldiers and bullfighting into a Mexican border type of story, an immigrant story.
Yeah, it opens with this woman called Carmen who is fleeing across the Mexican desert. Her mother has been murdered brutally and she is trying to get across the border. Paul Mescal plays a military veteran. He served in Afghanistan and he is... That's him playing in a quarry by himself with his acoustic guitar. And let me tell you, by the way, if you are a fan of, you know, beautifully composed shots of Paul Mescal brooding, that is like half this film. Yeah. So you're going to be happy. Yeah, they come across each other and end up on the run, essentially.
Yeah, and it does become, it's not quite a Bonnie and Clyde type of thing. But I'm not sure that plot is even essential. It struck me, the dance elements, the music elements, it's more of an atmosphere piece than this, Deirdre, than anything else.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, there's a lot of effort kind of put into, I would say more so the cinema. Photography and the choreography as opposed to like the plot itself, because it's not a film in which an awful lot happens, and it's not a film in which there's even that much dialogue in it. Now, it has some really beautiful moments. There are shots of the Mexican desert. You've got this gorgeous orange-hued cinematography going throughout it. But I did notice, and this is a tendency I've noted anyway, sometimes when you get these directorial debuts, is that the filmmaker is really eager to use cinema for all of its visual potential. So there's much more of an emphasis in how the film looks and sounds, like with the dramatic lighting, there's extreme close-ups, the big vista shots, at the cost of other elements, which in this case I would say the entertainment value. It's a bit kind of artsy.
Stars from you on this one, Deirdre.
I couldn't help but find it a bit dull, if I'm honest. It's nearly 2 hours, very little happens in it, and I found it a bit of a slog. So for me, 2.5 out of 5.
2.5, and that's for the dancing.
That's
and
for
singing.
Paul.
Paul, what are you saying, Dave?
3 stars for me. I found it mesmerising at times, but it does suffer from a lack of kind of characterisation. Yeah. And I should say a lot of credit should go to Nicholas Britell, who did the music for this film and has done amazing music for Succession.
Yeah,
and if Beale Street could talk, his score here is excellent.
Yeah, the score is really, really interesting, I have to say. Let's move on then. So 2.5 and 3 respectively there. Let's move on to the film Reality. Last night I spoke to Tina Satter, who is the writer and director of this film. Tells the story of a 25-year-old US intelligence analyst called Reality Lee Winner, who leaked a top-secret NSA report into Russian interference in the 2016 US presidential election to the media. The dialogue is taken entirely from transcripts of her initial interrogation with the FBI as they searched her house in June of 2017. The dialogue is extraordinary here, and it is real dialogue, Deirdre.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And this was what's interesting about this script, which was both written as well as this film being directed by Tina Satter. It was originally a play, but it's been really effectively adapted into a film, because we're seeing not just the recreation by the actors, we also see the transcript text, we see like these sound waves. And it's really interesting as well, because obviously some of this transcript would have had to be redacted, and that's established through sometimes there's just silence, sometimes there's like this kind of blinking on the screen, and sometimes we see like the actual transcript with parts blackened out of it. So the way that they've adapted this true story for the film medium is absolutely fascinating. And another thing that I love about this is it runs for a total of 80 minutes. I just love a tight movie like this. And it's so intense. You are completely immersed from start to finish.
Yeah. And when she spoke to me last night, I asked Tina Satter, obviously they cut a bit of it, but it more or less runs in real time. She said, we cut the more languorous bits of conversation in and around uneventful matters. But they didn't even change the order of it. So as I said to her, she didn't really write it. She kind of, it's more about the direction here than it is about the writing. The transcript is the writing.
Yeah, I mean, you're dealing with, like, you know, a very, very small thing in one respect, because you just have people talking to each other in an awkward situation, you know, inside a house, outside a house. And, you know, they're having everyday conversations, but there's just threatening, like, there's threatening air to everything that's happening. And the three main performers in this, Sydney Sweeney, Josh Hamilton and Marshawn Davis, are all excellent at delivering that. And, yeah, and, like, I thought in your interview with Tina Satter, like, it came across that she was very protective, I think, of this real-life figure and wanted to tell her story in the right way. But by using the actual dialogue of how it was recorded on a dictaphone and just having the actors recite this, but do it in their own way. And Sydney Sweeney in particular, who has this incredibly expressive face and gets to use it and run the kind of full range of emotions here. I thought that that was quite incredible, because you get all these dialogue sections that seem mundane, but happened and thus have to be there. But they feel kind of, you know, like on a knife edge or something.
Well, let's have a listen to a section where they're simply talking about a dog. And I think it's I think it's Marshawn Davis who's talking to Sydney Sweeney here about the dog.
So, is your dog friendly?
Okay, well, so she doesn't like men.
Okay.
So.
So that's a problem.
Yeah. She may come towards you, but she's never bitten anybody. She's not aggressive. She's just got, you know, a really good growl going.
Okay.
She'll probably hide under my desk.
Do you have a leash or something?
I have a leash.
Okay.
I can get her leashed up.
And that's Sydney Sweeney as reality, the character reality. And it was Marshawn Davis there as the agent in the scene from the film Reality. And Deirdre, you know, that's quite kind of bland in some ways. And that's outside the house. It moves inside the house for act two, if you like. Yeah. And as Tina Satter said to me, it's perfectly structured. Acts one, two and three in the actual interrogation itself. Things do get very tense when it moves inside.
Yeah, that's just it. And it's interesting because what the writer-director has included here are kind of these sudden noises in the conversation and even all these accidental interruptions, which just add to the tension, which is really like quite relentless for the 80 minutes. You kind of wonder if you could even watch any more of this. But really, it is the performers who bring this script to life. Sydney Sweeney is just exquisite. People might recognise her. She was previously in such series as The White Lotus and Euphoria. Mm. But there's so much going on in her performance. There's so little said, but you can see the nervousness in her eyes, in her like small gestures, the fact that she's trying to keep things casual. She almost acts like she's a bit naive and she doesn't know what's going on here. And the agents played by Josh Hamilton and Marshawn Davis are excellent as well, giving these good cop, kind of bad cop vibes. Even Agent Garrick acts like he's the one who's meant to be nervous, while you have Agent Taylor as the totally stoic, totally serious one. And it's just so compelling to watch.
Stars from you, Deirdre.
For me, this is the movie of the week. I just think it's such an exquisitely made film. I love that there's a degree of kind of tragedy and something really kind of contemplative and compelling in that finale. 4 out of 5 stars for me. This is my favourite movie this week.
It's a real life story, and often, you know, the truth is stranger than fiction, and therefore it does comes across as odd on the screen. Did the true aspect of this, did the film ring true for you, even though it was a true story just being told as it happened, as it were, Dave?
Yeah, I think so. The acting is excellent, but it's not over the top. I mean, this didn't feel like they were looking to just kind of have their For Your Consideration awards worthy real thing going on. And I will say, like, you know, for real life case, it is kind of the less you know, the better from an entertainment point of view.
Don't go Googling.
Yeah, to be fair, if you listen to us now and you're like, that sounds interesting, don't go Googling. Watch the film. The performances are more than enough. I will say, trust me, I'm all for brevity. I love an 80-minute movie like nobody else, but I kind of wanted 10 more minutes here.
You want another 10 minutes. Okay, yeah. Maybe that's the sequel.
Yeah, 3.5 stars for me anyway.
3.5 from you on that, Dave. Okay, let us move on then to Across the Spider-Verse. Spider people, as we know, exist in many different dimensions. different iterations, different personalities. And in Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse animated Spider-Man, Miles Morales is grappling with the micro and macro problems involving his family on one hand and the end of the world on the other. Big task to be dealing with both of those things as an animated character, isn't it, Dave?
And a big task to try and even set up the plot for this movie because, you know, in my notes I just found myself writing and writing and writing. But I was inspired by the film. I found this to be incredibly life-affirming at times and joyous at other times as well. If you're unfamiliar somehow with this, it is about Spider-Man, but it's all animated. It's the sequel to Across the Spider-Verse from, or sorry, Into the Spider-Verse from 2018. And it's just throwing every kind of visual art style, live action, cell shaded, traditional hand drawings. It's all mashed together at 100 miles an hour. And yes, the character work, though, is here. The emotional elements are here as well. We're mostly following Miles Morales, who's a teenager, who's grappling with what it takes to be a hero and the kind of family problems, the relationship problems. Then you've got other people in different dimensions. They all crash together. Somehow this thing has heart, rhythm, pace, humor. It has everything.
Do I need to know about the Spider-Verse and the several different aspects and you know, parallel Spider-Verses that are involved? Do I need to know about Tom Holland? Do I need to know about Tobey Maguire? Do I need to know about Andrew Garfield, all former Spider-Men, as it were?
No, certainly not. I don't think so. I mean, you'll definitely get a lot more out of it because if there ever was fan service in a movie, you're going to get it here if you've been watching all the Spider-Man movies and all the superhero movies all along. And I think that what Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse does really effectively is that it does use the first act to really kind of establish, if you did miss Into the Spider-Verse, kind of establishing like the
first
backstory.
Film, the first animated film.
In this particular series, exactly, at establishing that backstory. As someone who had seen the previous movie, now I was a bit frustrated because I felt like I was kind of watching the same stuff I already knew about from the first film, and I just wish that maybe they hadn't spent quite so much time doing that because I was just waiting for the plot to kick into gear, really. But at that, there are so many elements in the first film that work so well that you get again here. You have absolutely stunning animation. Each Spider-Man has its own like unique and striking, incredible design. As like in one scene we go to, as opposed to Manhattan, Mumbatan, which is like with an Indian Peter Parker. There's also this fun British punk rock Spider-Man who is voiced by Daniel Kaluuya.
The parallel universes.
Oh, so much fun. And then there's great humour in it. There's gripping action. There's a terrific soundtrack as well, and a lot of heart, actually.
And of course, all that really matters is Miles Morales, Spider-Man, and Gwen Stacy. I mean, will they, won't they? That's the plot here, isn't it?
Yeah, the teenage romance for the ages. Yeah. And you have, she's Spider-Woman in her dimension. He is madly in love with her, of course. And she's resisting to that because of, you know, what fate has decided for them in the past. Mm. It's a very self-aware film in a lot of respects. And yes, there is an overwhelming nature to what you see on the screen. And even going in, there is a lot of baggage as well. But I do think you can surrender to what is in front of you. And I do think you will be swept away by it. And look, we're living in a time where blockbusters can be very, very mind-numbing, including superhero stuff, and even like the most recent Fast and the Furious film, which was one of the worst things I've seen all year and just a total waste of money. I sat down for this with a little bit of apprehension and I found myself completely with it at every step of the way. Yeah.
Well, I have a clip featuring Shemek Moore plays the Miles Morales Spider-Man character and in Gwen Stacy, who is played by Hayley Steinfeld, isn't it? Yeah. And here's just the beautiful, tender moment between the two of them. And again, as you say, you don't need to know anything really about the story to work out what's happening here.
You and me, it's...
we're the same. In the important ways, you know?
In every other universe, Gwen Stacy falls for Spider-Man. And in every other universe, it doesn't end well.
Well, it's the first time for everything, right?
So every broken teenage heart out there, there's a first time for everything. And, you know, in some parallel universe, things might be a lot better. That's gorgeous little tender scene between Shemek Moore and Hayley Steinfeld there, Deirdre.
Yeah, and what I love about this film as well is that, you know, I think that with Spider-Man, there's such an emphasis on the romance. Who will Peter end up with, you know, Gwen or MJ, Mary Jane? But I think that what this particular, version of Spider-Man is about is it's really friendship, and it's about finding your tribe and bonding over this shared experience of trauma and loss. And he really finds that in all the iterations of Spider-Man he meets. And it's really quite emotional as a result. And I just think Miles Morales as well, he's proven to be such a kind of compelling protagonist. Mm. He's resilient, he's inspiring, but he doesn't shy away from, you know, being hurt or vulnerable either. So it's really kind of a gorgeous series. I do have a couple of complaints about this particular film, though. The whole multiverse concept, it did start to get a little bit too convoluted, I will say, in that third act. And annoyingly, there is a cliffhanger ending, and just that irks me so much. It happened with Fast X as well, and I'm just like, why won't you give me a complete film here?
Okay, well, if you've got Spider-Man into the universe, Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse, Spider-Man across the Spider-Verse, I think there's probably a third one on the way.
Traversing
as well.
The Spider-Verse, who knows?
Out of the beyond the, who knows?
It is called Beyond.
I was thinking it was.
Oh, there you go. Well done.
Did it work overall for you? Dave, and stars.
Well, I totally accept the fact that it does stuff an awful lot in, and it can
140 minutes.
It's a little too long. It's a bit overwhelming. There's a ton happening here, and it's a sugar rush. You could walk away with a bit of a headache, but it did work for me. And those little kind of beats, I think, are beautiful. And I think as well, like Shameik Moore should be a bigger star, even away from animation. Yeah, but the voice acting all around, whether it's him, Hayley Steinfeld, Oscar Isaac as the Mexican / Irish Spider-Man, Miguel O'Hara, and I haven't mentioned him, Jason Schwartzman as the villain. There's so much love and attention to detail in this. And overall, yeah, I felt like a kid again. I'm in my late 30s. I thought it ruled. I'm going 4.5 stars.
4.5 from you. What did you say? Did you give a star to it?
I'm going to give I absolutely love this franchise, but I didn't love this on the same level as Into the Spider-Verse. It is difficult to review when I feel like it's incomplete, and it is a bit too long. So 3.5 for me. But I'm between 3.5 and 4 because I do love these movies.
You'll both be at 5 before you get out the door. Okay, but I take both your points, right? 3.5, 4.5. So pretty positive from both of you. Let's go on then to our final film this evening, The Bogeyman. Finally, I'll get it in its singular form. New film from director of The Host and Dasham. This is Rob Savage, based on a Stephen King short story where a demonic presence terrorizes those already afflicted by pain and suffering. That feels like a sentence I could put into 3,000 scripts about Stephen King and about horror movies. The Harper family are the poor people at stake who are in trouble here. Why are they in so much trouble, Dave?
They are grieving the loss of the mother of the family, and there's a demon that feeds on this kind of thing, essentially, kind of trauma and pain. Like this thing of, you know, horror movies dealing with grief, that's fine, but like this kind of, you know, trauma core that we can't get away from. This film seems to think it's an original thing, but like the Babadook needs to conjure up a lawyer and have a conversation, because it's just a fairly straight ripoff. But then you can point to the Stephen King story from 1973. That's fine. It's extremely derivative is what I'm getting at. The family unit is done well. The actors are good, particularly Chris Messina and Sophie Thatcher.
He's the dad, and then their two sisters survive the mother's death. And that it's Sophie Thatcher and Vivian Lyra Blair.
Yeah, they're good. Like everyone here is solid. It looks fine, but it's just, I knew from frame one, I was like, I've seen this before. It's so generic. It's weightless as well. And this is a film that opens with like an off-screen child murder. And you're like, oh God, are we really going to be going there? But there's no way to any of it. I sat there in the cinema, and I love horror movies. I absolutely do. But all I could think about was stuff that has come out this year, like Skinamarink or Evil Dead Rise. Even The Scream, like the most recent one, I was like, they all have some degree of invention and abstraction to them. This was just, you know, every horror film you've ever seen.
All right, let's take a clip. After the grief and all the pain that the two sisters and the dad are suffering, I guess he's a psychiatrist, isn't he, as well? So he's helping everybody through their grief. A stranger comes to the house, a man called Lester, played by David Dastmalchian, is that how I say his name? And here is a little scene where he's speaking to them, and a little bit of language toward the end of it.
They called it the Boogeyman. Yeah, that's the way I used to look at them. Like they were crazy. Found out the hard way I was wrong. Likes to play with its food, scare them to death. Shit, it can even talk like them. Like a goddamn echo. It needs the dark to stay hidden. Fire was the first thing man used to see at night. It's really been around that long. I think it's been around forever.
Ooh. The boogeyman. Who wants the boogeyman coming anywhere near them? And that's in the Harper's household where Lester, the character of Lester, is visiting them. Is it scary? Did it work for you, Deirdre?
See, I'm probably the wrong one to ask because, as I mentioned in the previous show when I was talking about Evil Dead Rise, I don't particularly like horror movies because I don't really like to be scared. So I'm probably the wrong one to ask because I like the fact that I wasn't too scared by it. You know what I mean? But that's probably not a good reflection if you're looking for a horror movie. I mean, I did think probably all of the big scary parts, like there are kind of the loud sudden noises, there are the jump scares.
Quiet scenes like the one we just heard.
Yeah, exactly. Most of those are kind of reserved for the first act, and then it kind of gets more into, like, I suppose, a detective kind of storyline, because Sadie is investigating basically the origins of the boogeyman, the original family that he haunted, trying to figure out why is he now haunting hers.
Did it work for you? Were you scared? Was it worth it? I don't think so, Dave, from what you've said already. And stars.
I was never scared. I wanted to be. I mean, it does that kind of apprehension thing, and then you wait for the jump scare and it's just kind of wash, rinse, repeat. A little bit of atmosphere. It looks nice. There could have been a better story here, and I have to unfortunately give it 1.5 stars out of
5. 1.5. And Deirdre?
Ooh, I didn't dislike it that much. I mean, I feel like the storyline with Sadie kind of navigating school.
This is one of the sisters, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then the little sister who's played by Vivian Lyra Blair, who people might recognise, she was young Leia in Obi-Wan Kenobi. I think that their performances really kind of kept me invested in this movie. So I'd give it 3 out of 5.
It
was enjoyable enough for me.
Because you weren't scared.
But I'm not a horror fan.
Okay, that's our 4 movies for tonight. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse and The Boogeyman Go on general release this weekend. Reality is at the Lighthouse and the IFI. Carmen goes on limited release, including the IFI this weekend. And Dave Hanratty and Deirdre Malumbi are reviewers on this Thursday evening. The West Cork Chamber Music Festival is back in style later this month in and around Bantry Town. The festival has a packed programme, 50 concerts in 10 days and nights, and the celebrated Irish soprano Anna Devon will be performing. Anna joins me now from the Cork studio. And it's not, Anna, that you're so far ahead of yourself that you've got yourself into Cork at the beginning of June so that you can perform there at the end of June. You're actually a little bit busy at the moment as well. Not tonight, obviously, but tomorrow night.
That's right, yeah. I'm here in Cork singing with Irish National Opera at the Cork Opera House. Tomorrow is the last show in a long run of Così Van Tutte. Mm. I'm really excited. We sang or performed there last night and it was a great audience and it's a beautiful opera house to sing in. So tomorrow will be the last one, so it'll be extra special. So yeah. There probably will be a few seats left. So if anyone fancies it... come on. And Magella Culla, a famous Irish Cork girl, is singing with us. And my little claim to fame is that my mum's from Monkstown, so in Cork, not Monkstown in Dublin.
Right.
So I'm half Cork.
Well, I'd say Cork would be telling you you're far more than half Cork. However,
do you think?
I would say they'd be claiming you. Fior de Ligi is the character you're playing there in Mozart. But it's interesting that it is Mozart because... hearing Mozart, I think, Anna, for you was quite a big moment. In your very young life, you were listening to the music of Mozart, maybe by kind of default because it was on in the house, but it was there nonetheless.
It was, yeah. Mozart is definitely the composer that spurred my interest in opera. There was a CD. My dad was always one for the getting the latest technology, still to this day, and he was one of the first people to have a CD player, and we had the CD of Lucia Popp singing Mozart arias, famous Mozart arias, and some of the arias from that disc still now when I hear them it's like I'm instantaneously like back in the sitting room. I was like 6 or 7 at the time, but also my parents brought me to see, ironically, they brought me to see Le Nozze di Figaro,
right?
But the reason they brought it was because they saw a production of Così Van Tutte in Trinity. It was a student production and that's what spurred their interest in opera, so they thought, oh, we'll bring them along and see, and I just fell in love with it. So Well, yeah, I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
The fact that they're now seeing you or can see you now in Cosey is quite a, it's a, quite a lovely kind of completion
yeah,
of the circle.
Exactly.
But do you, it was Regina Nathan, I think, who was playing in Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. Do you remember seeing that? Like,
yeah.
What kind of age were you?
I think I was about 6.
Wow.
And I just remember the character of Susanna was just like so clear. And I have sung Susanna like 45 times. So I fulfilled that childhood dream a while ago. But yeah, she was so clear. And we also, I saw the Die Zauberflöte, the Magic Flute, which is another Mozart opera, around the same time. It must have been the year after, because it was Dublin Grand Opera, I think. And those are pictures. It's the vivid pictures. I'm a very visual person, so I remember all the pictures. I don't remember the singing, which is ironic, but I remember the pictures of what was happening on the set, you know. There was this checkered floor and there was neon costumes. That's yeah. So
it's amazing that that visual memory is still there.
Yeah.
But you know, this idea of, you know, we've often heard the argument that listening to Mozart or Bach in the womb,
yeah,
your child's going to be a genius if they're listening to either of those two composers, either mathematical or I suppose classically brilliant.
Yeah.
In terms of those composers,
I'd have to see. I've got two girls, so my eldest was I sang something like 20 performances of Susanna in Le Nozze di Figaro when she was in my womb. And then my second one, I sang a lot of Handel when I was pregnant with her. So we'll see. They're only 6 and nearly 3, so time will tell.
Yeah, a little bit. But of course, well, you were listening to and seeing Mozart at the age of 6. And I suppose your older daughter, could she come and see you?
Could
she manage it?
Yeah, annoyingly, just the way this production, we live in England, so the way of production, she had gone home. But my nieces and my colleague, Sharon Carty, and friend, her niece and nephew, they all came to the matinee in Dublin last week. And my nieces are just gone 6 and nearly 8. And
right.
Hers were 4 and 2. And they all sat through nearly the whole thing. They went out a little bit in the second half just for a breather and then came back in. But they loved it. And the questions as the day went, you know, in the evening, I was with my niece. The little things that they remembered and all these amazing questions, you know. So, I think you have to find the appropriate opera and preferably a matinee. But I think that, you know, from the age of six, they could sit through it. But I've been bringing my daughters since they were tiny.
Yeah, and before.
Yeah, well. And before, yeah.
They were actually on the stage beforehand with
exactly.
you as you sang. Now, you mentioned Handel in the midst of all of that. I think it was with your second daughter. You said you were, when you were pregnant with her, you were singing Handel. It is a very specific period in time. It strikes me the type of opera that I know you like all kinds of opera, obviously, but Handel and Mozart seem to be kind of very important. That kind of the Baroque period and the early classical period, a very specific type. I want to listen to a little bit of it's you singing, isn't it? In fact, from Arminio, from Act One of a Handel opera. Maybe you tell us a little bit about what this aria is about and what your character is doing here.
You're questioning me. I haven't sung that opera in 7 years.
So I want all the detail. Can you translate it?
But I remember in the staging in this aria, basically I'm singing to my brother who's in love with another girl. And I also want to marry the man I'm in love with, but I'm not allowed to. They're trying to like sell me off to marry a different emperor. You know, it's a real old story.
So classic old thing of you, neither of you can get the person that you want in marriage.
Yeah, so it's kind of about love and the signs of love and what's to come. It came quite early in the opera, so
Let's have a listen to a little bit of it. Listen to that all night. That's Evil Segno d'un debole amore from Handel's Arminio. And it was the voice of Anna Devon that you heard there, who's joining me from Cork this evening ahead of her appearance at the West Cork Chamber Music Festival towards the end of the month. It really strikes me, Anna, how contained Handel is in particular. Well, in that particular style of minor key aria, broken-hearted arias.
Yeah.
It is restrained in a way that maybe we don't associate with opera.
Yeah, it's interesting that you look at it like that, because there are restrained moments, but the thing that Handel does so amazingly is that he knows how to write so well dramatically, and Mozart would be the same in terms of what exact musical colour do we need to convey the exact emotion that the character's feeling at any given time. And both Mozart and Handel do that, in my opinion, some of the best. And they do it, but also leave the space for the singer to create the character. They don't enforce a full colour palette on the score. And I think that's one of the geniuses of both of them. And I suppose for me, particularly with Handel, like the thing that's so great about him is you get the ornamentation in the, you know, when you sing the tune again.
Yeah.
And you can put your own style on that. You can decide what's the right thing for the character that you decide. You know, you could play the role of Tusnelda, that was the role of their, you know, in five different productions and change it every single time, depending on who else is on stage with you, because that's so key to how you perform. Well, for me in particular, like I'm quite intuitive and aware of other people's, energies on stage.
Yeah.
And so, they change how I play my character depending on who's with me.
Yeah. So that da capo aria, that idea of from the beginning again, you go back to the beginning, you sing the first verse again, but you can ornament and play around it. In terms of what you're going to be doing in West Cork then.
Yeah.
Are you taking... I know there's a number of performances that you're doing towards the end of the month.
Yeah.
Will you be taking sections from operas, or are you doing specific pieces? What's the plan?
No, so I've got three concerts and oh, so lucky is me that they're all at 11 a.m. They're coffee concerts, which is great for everyone else, but it means I have to go to bed very early and up very early.
And can you get the voice awake by 11 a.m?
Well, if I get up at 5:30, yeah.
Wow.
So
and it is that it would take that time to get
for
it.
Me. It's partly to do with your body. You know, you need time for your body to wake up to really sing your best, and if you really want to enjoy it. So they tried to put me for a rehearsal in the evening, and I was like, I'm not rehearsing. I'll be in bed every night at 8 a.m. that week, so that I can switch my, you know, like if you go to a different country, I'll switch my body clock for the week. So yeah, but anyway, there's three concerts, and two of them are with this French ensemble called Ensemble d'Itero. I think that's how you pronounce it. And they're a Baroque ensemble, and a bit like string quartet, but they add extra instruments if they need it. So we're going to do some cantatas, and they're both Italian cantatas. One is by Handel and one is by this fantastic composer called Karl Heinrich Graun, or Grün.
Yeah.
And he's not very well known, but the music is absolutely beautiful, and it's always tricky with unknown composers to try and convince people to come, but all I can say is, if anyone's listening, if you like Handel, you're going to like his music as well. So these Italian cantatas, the thing that's so amazing about them is like they're anywhere from like 12 to 20 to 30 minutes long, but they're like mini operas. Like the characters, the one by Graun is Apollo and Daphne. It's based on the story of Apollo and Daphne. So Daphne escapes her divine rapist Apollo, and the cantata is based on her transformation into a laurel tree to escape him. So like there's big emotions in what's a chamber music setting. So you know, it's a concert setting, whatever. But the thing that really excites me about it is the fact that you can bring all the drama to it that you would bring to an opera. And the Handel cantata we're doing is Armida Abbandonata. And it's one of his very famous cantatas. And I'm really looking forward to singing both of them.
Yeah, and I can hear even from listening to the bit of Handel that we heard there that the Handel will really sit well on your voice. And I don't know the composer, the other composer.
No, neither did I.
So I have to go finding out a little bit more about him.
Yeah.
In the meantime, are you annoyed now that you had to talk to me tonight? Should you be resting the voice tonight ahead of tomorrow's performance?
I should. But like I haven't spoken to anyone all day, so
saved it all for me.
I did save it all for you, and I should mention. Sorry, I forgot. The third concert is something I'm also very excited about, which is a recital, a solo recital with Deirdre Bremner, who's an Irish American pianist, and we're doing a loads of English English song, but with Irish, mostly Irish poetry. So we're doing lots of Yeats and Joyce. So that'll be really exciting.
Yeah,
as well.
Heaven's Cloth is in there, an Irish.
Yeah, my favorite poem.
And Secret of Old from Yeats.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Solitary Hotel from Joyce. So lots to whet the appetite there.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for being with us this evening,
for having
Anna.
Me.
And go now. No talking.
I will. There'll be no talking till tomorrow. And thanks a million. Look after yourself.
You too, Anna. That's Anna Devon there, who'll be performing at the West Cork Chamber Music Festival, which takes place in and around Bantry from June the 23rd to July the 2nd, westcorkmusic.ie, and of course tomorrow evening that final performance at the Cork Opera House of the Irish National Opera production of Mozart's Così fan tutte. Thirty-nine fashion photography portraits are now on display at the Ulster Museum in Belfast in an exhibition called A Century of Style, Fashion Photography from the National Portrait Gallery, the National Portrait Gallery in London being the National Portrait Gallery in question here. Photographers represented include Cecil Beaton, Irving Penn, Norman Parkinson and Miles Aldridge. Subjects like Twiggy, Audrey Hepburn and Stormzy. I'm joined now by Charlotte McReynolds from the Ulster Museum to tell us more about this. How come that you've got your hands on quite a stock of stuff from the National Portrait Gallery in London? What little bit of joy did you get that allowed that, Charlotte?
Oh, hello there. Thanks for having me on. Well, we're just very, very fortunate. At the moment, the National Portrait Gallery in London is closed to the public for a big redevelopment project. So in order to keep their collections accessible to the public, they reached out to a number of partners, us at the Ulster Museum included, and basically asked us what would we like to have on loan to us. As a taste of their collection, which, you know, just at the present moment, the public can't go and see, but they will be soon.
Yeah, and what criteria did you use then? Like, if you're asked, you know, come over and take whatever you want and bring it back home and show it in your place. What criteria did you use to make a choice for this exhibition?
I mean, we could have taken anything because the National Portrait Gallery in London has paintings as well as all of these wonderful photographs. But because the Ulster Museum is unique in having a fashion collection, which I normally curate, as well as a photography collection, we didn't have a fashion photography collection. Oh.
Right.
So it seemed like it was a bit of a no-brainer for this exhibition to be a chance to fill in that gap.
Yeah. Let's have a look at some specific portraits within all of that. I'm going to tweet these portraits as we go along so people can see them.
Oh.
At RTE Arena to do that. And the first one we're going to see is Audrey Hepburn by Cecil Beaton. This comes from 1963. Extraordinary shot, this one, Audrey. Or Charlotte, I beg your pardon. You're not Audrey Hepburn. It's Charlotte McReynolds that I have on. It is an extraordinary shot of her, isn't it?
Oh, it's really beautiful. I think, I think it's really quite a tender image.
With her eyes looking down.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a sort of a head and shoulders shot of Audrey Hepburn wearing this unusual, almost turban-like hat with this little bit of a feather trim around it. And she looks, you know, particularly, I think, a bit fragile in that image. And Cecil Beaton absolutely adored Audrey Hepburn. He photographed her, I think, hundreds of times over her career. And he was, in fact, the one who designed her costumes and dressed her for My Fair Lady. So if you think of that iconic scene in My Fair Lady of everybody at the races and these amazing black and white outfits, that was all entirely composed by Cecil Beaton. And, you know, their love was mutual. She always said that she felt that Cecil Beaton made her feel beautiful. And it's sort of funny to think that Audrey Hepburn didn't always feel beautiful, but and I think that really it comes across in the image.
Yeah, there is something very
lovely relationship.
Yeah, very, very gentle about it, as you say. And equally gentle, I want to put one of a man up there too, because I'm guessing these are perhaps harder to find in the world of fashion, photography.
Bit.
Yeah, Stormzy. This is at RTE Arena to see Stormzy. This is a photograph by Olivia Rose from 2016. This is not the Stormzy that we know from the stage. This is not the man who wears the big vest out at Glastonbury. This is a very contemplative, quiet man sitting on a stool in a backyard, essentially. Beautiful shot again.
It is. It's a quiet image, really. And as you say, the fashion world, it is often dominated by women's fashion. And I did make the extra effort to see if I could find some good examples of men's fashion for the exhibition. And what I like about this image is several things. It gets across a lot of the images, you know, are very beautiful and very poised and of, you know, really high-end fashion. But in this image, Stormzy is wearing his Adidas tracksuit and his trademark sort of socks and slides. And it brings it all right up to date. And I think what's nice about this image as well is we've had so many comments from the public that because there are so many recognizable faces in this exhibition, from sort of Marlena Dietrich right up to Stormzy, all the different generations visiting seem to find somebody that they recognize in it.
And anybody who's looking for that they can wear their socks with their sandals, Stormzy will give you a reason to say, Stormzy does it, I can do it.
It's high fashion.
It's high fashion. Well, listen, thanks so much for sharing just two of those 39 images. It certainly looks like and sounds like a very interesting exhibition. That's Charlotte McReynolds. And the exhibition is called A Century of Style, Fashion Photography from the National Portrait Gallery in London. It's on display at the Ulster Museum in Belfast through until the 30th of September. Ulstermuseum.org will give you all of the details there.